It is 25 minutes after the hour. It's we want to synchronize our watches. 3, 2, 1, click. Okay, we got it.
It's 7:24.
I got. See, you're still 2 minutes fast. We have to do it again until we get it right. You know. No, let's not do that. Let's move on because Pastor Robbie Pruitt joins us this morning from Ashburn, Virginia. Robbie's an Anglican pastor, a member of the board at Preserving Bible Times, and he's become a great friend of the station. It's already been a year plus, Robbie. I can't believe the time flies. We must be having fun.
Indeed. Thanks for having me on, Jim. Good to be with you and David. It has been, 15 months.
Yeah. Yeah. So your podcast library is growing too on Broken Road Radio. Weekly conversations with Robbie, and not just because he's with Preserving Bible Times, but because he knows his stuff. We talk to him about biblical context. And this being Holy Week, we are rife with topics and subject matter and places we can go to that could take all day. So picking a place to start is a challenge, but I've got an idea. Let's start with the day of the Last Supper. And which day of the week that was, we will discuss shortly here. But at the beginning, I'm presuming that Jesus and his apostles are on the Olive Garden side of the Kidron Valley, not in Jerusalem. And they're wondering where they're going to have the Seder meal, if it is a Seder meal, at least what we call the Last Supper. And Jesus tells them, go through the gate and look for a man carrying water. Mm. Now, that's a clue. And it calls for a little history. But Robbie, how would you interpret that? What was he telling them?
Well, we talked about this a little bit last year as well, this mm-hmm. idea that men do not normally carry water in this society, which has given us a clue to possibly what side of town they're on.
Mm-hmm. Well, the history goes back to Herod the Great's time. The Essenes were another religious faction in Israel, like the Pharisees, like the Sadducees, like the Hasidim in the Galilee region. But they hung out in Qumran those days, which is just on the west side of the Dead Sea. And back in it was probably, I don't remember the exact year, it's on record, but it's around the time Jesus was born, or maybe just before, there was a huge earthquake. And their settlement at Qumran was destroyed. But one of their prophets had flattered Herod the Great by predicting that he would have a long and productive and happy reign. And in order to return the favor, he said, I'll rescue you from your ruins there. Come to Jerusalem. We'll set aside a portion of the city for you. That became known as the Essene Quarter. And I think it's still there today. Now, that's if you can, I don't know how many of our listeners have seen the Jerusalem model, but if you can envision that like from a bird's eye view, there's the south gate to Jerusalem. And as you go through the gate, immediately to your left and onward up a ways is the Essene Quarter. So it's just to the west of the south entrance to the town through the city wall. So what Jesus was saying, I think, was there will be a man there carrying water because there were no women in the Essene community.
Mm.
And so that's an important contextual clue as to where the Last Supper may well have been held, in the Essene Quarter. But there's another question that occurs to me on top of that. Why didn't he say, go down to 401 Herod Avenue, that's where we're going to do it? I mean, did Jesus know? Why the secrecy? It's intriguing to try to figure that out, and hopefully the understanding is that he meant the Essene Quarter because it was a quiet place where he could get away from the crowds, and it was the proper environment for what he wanted to do. But why not just give him the address?
Mm.
Now, there may not have been street numbers, I know.
It took me living in Haiti to kind of get my mind around a first century context. When my wife and I spent 5 years in Port-au-Prince, Haiti, I entered into this agricultural society that is not as laid out and as measured as our streets are today. I mean, everything's a landmark, and everything's this is near this, and turn a right or a left at this place. And there were really just very few, if any, street signs or names. I mean, that's one reason he's not doing it. I don't think things are, even today, if you walk the streets of Jerusalem, and that's one of my favorite things to do. I've been to Israel twice, and just to walk the streets of Jerusalem at night, it's a labyrinth. I mean, it just really is a labyrinth of pathways. But yeah, that Essene quarter would have been at the southwest corner of the city walls in the first century.
Well, and probably it's, to envision that, it would have been narrow, winding streets because of the way houses were built in those days and the way clans functioned. You know, your parents would have sons, and they would go away and bring up and find a bride and come back and build a house adjacent to their dad's house, and so on and so forth through the generations. So the clans tended to stay together in little mini neighborhoods, probably not unlike what was done with ethnic clans in this country back in the 19th century, except streets much, because everything was walking distance. There weren't street lights and left turn lanes. Maybe there were no house numbers, or because you knew where everybody was. And there were wells, which was a center of social activity. And that probably existed in the Essene quarter as well, even though they had no gathering of women there, sharing the news of the day and gossiping and gathering water at a set time. But the men would have carried water because there were no women.
Yeah. So our passage here is Luke 22, starting at verse 7. Then came the day of the unleavened bread, on which the Passover lamb had to be sacrificed. And again, this is remembering the Exodus, when God delivered his people out of slavery in Egypt. So Jesus sent Peter and John, saying, "Go and prepare the Passover for us, that we may eat of it." And they said to him, "Where will you have us prepare it?" And this is verse 10 of Luke 22. He said to them, "Behold, when you have entered the city, a man carrying a jar of water will meet you. Follow him into the house that he enters and tell the master of the house, 'The teacher says to you, where is the guest room where I may eat the Passover with my disciples? And he will show you a large upper room furnished. Prepare it there.' And they went and found it just as he had told them. And they prepared the Passover." So you and I talked about this a little bit last week when we were, you know, talking about the triumphal entry and Jesus saying, you know, go and find these colts tied. And if someone says, you know, why are you taking these colts? Say, the Lord has need of
them. We talked about the question, was he psychic or had he prearranged it?
I mean, here he is spending all this time with his disciples. Like, when did you go and make these preparations that we didn't know about it? And how are you now telling us exactly what to expect and it be exactly as he has said? So,
well, in a way, that makes sense. They didn't write about it in their Gospels because they weren't told then. They weren't explained in detail where this was going to happen. So it's logical that this, to us, that's the way the information would come. But they've had to be wondering at the time, why all the secrecy? Why didn't you tell us this yesterday?
Right. And you know, the insights on this is endless. I mean, just since you and I talked last week, just this idea of, you know, if anybody asks why you were untying these donkeys, say the Lord hath need of it. I brought up the point that it's culturally normal that the Romans would commandeer people and things and places for their use, and Lord is referring to, you know, those who have authority over you. But then later on in that account, Jesus quotes, "Have you not read what is out of the mouth of babes shall call forth praise?" He's quoting Psalm chapter 8, which begins with, "O Lord, our Lord, how majestic is your name in all the earth." So in effect, he's invoking I am the name for God by invoking this remez, calling forth the entire chapter of Psalm 8. So there's this double play and this double meaning.
You know, that may have been useful, because how many other people, aside from his disciples, would have thought of him as Lord? That is, as God.
Right, and for him to have his authority questioned as he's cleansing the temple and as he enters in to Jerusalem, humble and riding on the donkey, when people are worshiping him, Hosanna in the highest, they're waving palm branches, a symbol of Israel. and nationalistic pride. I mean, they're saying, be quiet. And he says, if these be quiet, even the stones will cry out. And you mentioned, you know, the stones of, you know, that people will uprise and throw stones, but also on the western edge of the Mount of Olives are graves. Like, literally, the dead will rise and cry out, too. I mean, this idea
that I've not heard that idea, but yeah, you're right.
Yeah, there are these gravestones. So, Jesus, and I brought up the point last week that anytime you ask one question of Jesus, you have to ask two, because he's a 200% person. Mm-hmm. He's 100% man, 100% God, the dual nature of Christ. So, you can't just ask one question of how did he know? Well, how did Jesus know? Or how did Jesus, you know, the third, you know, second person.
The divine or the human side, yeah.
Yeah, the deity of Jesus here. How did Jesus, our Lord, know this? You know, mm-hmm. that this person would be carrying water at exactly when the disciples are going to arrive to go to that room that he has somehow miraculously prepared, or somehow without them
John,
knowing.
John gives us a clue at the end of his book. There are so many things he did that all the books in the world couldn't contain it. I mean, there was a lot going on that we're not told about in the Gospels, just day-to-day, hour-to-hour activities of Jesus the Christ. And so speculation, it sometimes that's all we have. You know, we know his character, we know who he was, why he was here. That imputes a certain logic. We could expect that what he did was purposeful, intentional, but we don't know the details.
Right. So, I mean, we're in the holiest week of the church, or the Passion of Jesus, kicked off by Palm Sunday, the triumphal entry, right into Monday of Holy Week, Tuesday, Wednesday of Holy Week, and then Maundy Thursday, where we are today. This idea of mandate, and John Stone Street just did, you know, covered what that means, this mm-hmm. mandate.
Maundy, that was I'd never heard that detailed an explanation before. That was really interesting.
Yeah, I mean, it basically goes to, as I have washed your feet, you also ought to wash one another's feet. David, we hear you eating those potato chips, by the way.
Well, okay, yeah. All right, I'll keep them quiet. Or get quieter potato chips, one of the other.
We started talking about the Passover feast, and you got hungry all of a sudden.
Well, we give David potato chips to calm him, you know. Just...
So I had the privilege to actually to be at a Seder at Shepherd's Heart Anglican Church in Fairfax, Virginia, on Saturday night. And it was, you know, we remembered what the Jews would do when they celebrated the Passover. And this is what Jesus would have done with his disciples to remember the Passover. And the point there, that Seder was made, that when you slaughter this lamb, and in the days of the Exodus, when they slaughtered the lamb, they took the hyssop branch and they painted the blood of the lamb on the doorposts of the home, but also required was that the lamb be eaten. Mm-hmm. And so you can hear the echoes of John saying, "Behold the Lamb of God who takes away the sin of the world." Not only does the blood need to be painted, but all of those in that household need to consume the lamb. They need to eat the lamb. So when Jesus says, "This is my body, which is given for you," the image there is the body of the lamb that has been slain, that the blood be painted over the doorpost and that lamb consumed, that this is part of the meal, the final meal before salvation comes, before the deliverance from slavery in Egypt. So the imagery at this Passover that Jesus is invoking, and it's very important, and in this man carrying water in the Essene Quarter, I mean, just the obsession of the Essenes over ritualistic purification, and this idea of water and cleansing, and, you know, in John's gospel, the theme of water and life. And, you know, your listeners would know about the Dead Sea Scrolls. And so the Essenes are the ones who are scribing the Dead Sea Scrolls.
They had been there for, what, a couple of hundred years, basically transcribing ancient Hebrew text into Greek, presumably. I mean, apart from the Septuagint, which was a whole different thing. But yeah, they'd been, and they had some very distinct views of, they had set themselves apart from traditional Judaism. And they had someone in mind that they referred to as the great teacher. Someone apart from the religious establishment in Jerusalem. And some say, one, that John the Baptist may have been an Essene.
Right.
And two, that Jesus himself, if not actually a part of that faction, was seen as the great leader at some point in his ministry.
Yeah, and this is why, you know, when John comes eating, you know, locusts and wild honey, wearing camel's hair, I mean, this is one of the two garments that are acceptable. And those in the priest in the temple system were wearing linen. So no one was wearing this camel hair in this time. So John is saying, I'm identifying with the prophet Elijah, number one. Mm-hmm. But number two, it's contrary to the temple power struggles and the power system, Temple Incorporated. And the Essenes actually had their own gate in the Essenes quarter, because the Essenes were so hyper-vigilant about purity. I mean, if you go to Qumran now, you can see where the Essenes were scribing and the Torah scrolls. You can go to the scriptorium. You can see the mikvod that are there near the Dead Sea on the northwest of the Dead Sea there. Mm-hmm. Is Qumran, and the Dead Sea scroll caves are still there. And, you know, just last year, they have found new archaeological discoveries, the first in 60 years, including those gold coins with the palms, mm-hmm, stamped on them that we talked about last week as we looked at the triumphal entry and with
national
the
national symbol of Israel. Yeah.
Yeah. So the Essenes were setting themselves apart, pulling themselves apart. I mean, you know, it makes me think about the modern day book that was just written by Rod Dreher called The Benedict Option, talking about the Benedictines pulling out into the wilderness. So this is old, old, old. I mean, the Essenes did this, you know, during way before the first century. And, mm-hmm, and so you see this removal of oneself from the culture, and even from the corrupt religious system in this case.
Now, something else I read about the Essenes is that in addition to ritual purity, they were also fanatical about hospitality, which means they may have offered Jesus this place. I mean, if there was some, especially if there was some previous connection with Jesus during some time in his ministry. One other thing about the Essenes, which leads me into the next question, and this is really controversial, because forever the church has believed that the Last Supper was held on a Thursday, because that jives with everything that happened subsequently too, because he had to die and be taken down from the cross before the Sabbath started, which would have been 6 p.m. on Friday. The Jewish day started at 6 p.m. on what we would see as the previous day. So Saturday is the Sabbath, but it starts at 6 p.m. Friday, which means Jesus was arrested in the wee small hours of Friday morning, according to church tradition. And that has a very heavy weight of, you know, 99% of the world thinks that's the way it worked. But there is a theory put out by some scholars that because the Essenes worked on a different calendar than the Jewish calendar, there was a two-day difference. Their Sabbath would have fallen on Tuesday at 6 p.m., which means that would have been the sacrifice of the Paschal Lamb and the Seder dinner for Essenes and anyone in their community. There's another factor in here, because if the Last Supper were actually held on a Tuesday night, there's a big gap in between when Jesus would have been arrested and tried and taken to the cross. What happened in that time? How do you explain that day? Well, legalists would tell you that the Sadducees, who were like the Supreme Court of the Jews, if they ever condemned a man to death, a capital executed, commanded that he be executed for a crime, they had to meet again 24 hours later in order to reconfirm it. It was too heavy a decision just to take lightly, so they wanted to make sure everybody had time to think it over. They would get back together again 24 hours later and talk it over and either confirm or refute the earlier decision, which now puts Jesus sometime in Thursday, maybe Thursday night, and it's almost like a gap that isn't explained in the Gospels. My personal feeling is it's unlikely, but it's an interesting angle that maybe they, because they were in such a hurry to get rid of this Jesus problem, they skipped that part. You know, what do you think, yeah, Robbie?
I'm on the traditional view, because Jesus is controlling the timeline. I mean, we see this throughout his entire life. No one takes my life from me, I lay it down. He's always telling people, don't tell anyone what just happened. And then he pushes the issue, starting with the triumphal entry and the overturning of the cleansing of the temple, telling this parable of the wicked tenants against the religious leaders, provoking them to take him to the cross. I mean, Jesus is in strict control of the timeline. Even what he says at the Passover meal to Judas, what you do, do quickly. And they think that, you know, the disciples think that they're sending Judas out for, that he's sending Judas out for some more bread or something. But really, he's saying the time is ticking. I need to get on the cross quickly here. So you need to get to the betrayal so that I can get to the cross. And so, you know, the scriptures tell us for the joy set before him, he endured the cross. I mean, he set his face to Jerusalem. And so all along the way, we see Jesus controlling the narrative, controlling the timeline, controlling.
That's a statement of intent, too. I mean, he set his face. That has more meaning than just the English words. It means he fixed Jerusalem in his attention. And probably, I'm seeing, it's a very serious and powerful image I see of that happening. It's like, I know, these people don't know, but I'm coming for this event at that time. You know, it's going to come to pass as was prophesied so long ago.
And so you see that as early as Luke chapter 9. I mean, this is the verse he set his face towards Jerusalem, that happens that early on in Luke chapter 9.
I'd like to see a painting of that. Just that moment, you know, wouldn't that be dramatic?
Yeah.
I mean, so, just knowing how he engineered his death. Well, parts of what he did, he said, because prophecy has to be fulfilled. It's almost like he knew the prophecies, which he did. So he arranged events so that they would coincide, so that they would provide evidence for who he was. Other times, it seems to be, to a layman on the outside, it would seem like coincidence, and yet it's still fulfilled prophecy. There were hundreds of prophecies that, in detail, predicted how he was going to die, where he was going to die, when he was going to die, and they all were right.
Yeah. As it came to pass, when the days were accomplished, that he should be received up, he settled himself fully to go to Jerusalem, one translation says. And as the time drew near that he would be taken up, he set his mind and set out on his way to Jerusalem, another translation says. So this idea that he was determined to journey towards Jerusalem.
Last Supper, washing of the feet. It helps if you totally ignore the traditional painting of the Last Supper, a Da Vinci's painting, which was on the outside of a building. He got it wrong. It was not a long picnic table with a tablecloth on it.
Everybody were not on one side.
Facing the camera. No, they weren't.
Right.
No. They were there for conversation in a traditional layout, and I've seen drawings of this, but it's a triclinium table, a three-sided table, And it's typically three people at a side, although they could make room for more if they needed. The fourth side was typically open so that servants could come and bring in food or entertainment could happen. And they were lying down. They were reclining. They were not sitting in chairs. They were lying on a couch with the feet to the rear and leaning on their left shoulder because they couldn't use in a way that was a reminder that they could not eat with their left hand. They ate the food there were no knives and forks. They had pieces of bread. This was the way and it would be dipped into bowls of various combinations of spices and sauces and things with their right hand only. To do otherwise would have been hugely offensive and sent everybody out probably of the room. Mm. So you lay on your left arm so you can see these people three to a side, or maybe four, and there was a pecking order to where the host would seat and the guest of honor, and where there would be a servant seated. And without on the radio, it's hard to make this clear, but if you can envision this, on the left far left corner on the end would have been the servant's seat, and this is where the scholars say Peter must have been. So it would have fallen to him to do the foot washing, which he didn't do. And so Jesus, which would have made this a highly embarrassing, he would have realized as soon as Jesus stood up to do it, that he blew it. And he should have been
very contrite. Vocal. Mm-hmm. That, oh, by Lord, by no means will you do this.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, he's the most vocal because he's the most guilty for not having done his job.
And so Jesus did that, and I want to say he was testing Peter, but he'd been grooming Peter all along to be the head of the church that would follow. So he was singled out, I think, for a reprimand here, in effect, by the foot washing. But it's something that typically only a servant would do. Nobody of any stature, social standing, would do that. And if anybody here at church has had a foot washing, you understand the feeling a little bit about having somebody else wash your feet. Yeah. It's a stunning thing.
Yeah, and I think that a lot we're projecting, even in our feeling of the awkwardness. Certainly, it's intimate and awkward to have someone mm-hmm. touch your feet. In general, but it's probably more awkward for us in the 21st century than it would have been for them. They're used to servants washing the feet. And this is a culture of hospitality, this mandatory hospitality, this idea that, you know, even if the Essenes weren't a hospitable people, this culture and this time frame is. So whether or not they're more or less, you know, hospitable than the average person, hospitality is custom and you know, cleansing, offering your guests water to wash, oil for anointing. All of this can be found in like Jesus's visit to Simon the Pharisee's house, where, you know, the woman comes in and she's washing his feet with her tears and wiping them with her hair and kissing his feet. And Simon's up in arms. If he knew what manner of woman this was, this is all in Luke chapter 7, by the way. And he says, Simon, I came into your house. You gave me no oil for my head. You did not wash my feet. You did not greet me with a kiss. And this woman has not ceased to kiss my feet, wash them with her tears, and anoint me with oil. So these are customary gestures of hospitality.
These would have been things in planned dinners, though, like banquets, and this was supposed to be a Seder supper, which was highly ritualized procedure for the Jews.
Yeah.
Certain prayers done in a certain order, certain parts of the meal eaten during, you know, a certain time, and foot washing. I'm not sure that the average guy out in the fields in Bethlehem would come in and have a servant to wash his feet. He'd do it himself, or he wouldn't do it at all. Right. So this was a special occasion, and so a lot of these things.
And it is necessary. I mean, it is necessary before you begin that to be clean, to wash your feet mm-hmm. before coming in. And so, yeah, Peter fell asleep on the job. But the other interesting thing about reclining, and we did this at our Seder, that the Jews will recline. They will lean, even today in the celebration of a Seder, they will lean at certain parts of the, quote, liturgy of the Seder meal, because this reclining was not something that slaves in Egypt were allowed to do, because reclining at table are for rich people to do, people who aren't enslaved.
Of course, that would be symbolic now, because these days it would be table and chairs for the family.
But, right. So now people are leaning to remember that they were able to recline at table. So again, we're no longer slaves. God has delivered us from slavery in Egypt. Now we can recline at table.
One of the traditions at a Seder meal is to have, and I think it was the fifth cup. It might have been the fourth cup. I've lost track of the count there. But there is a cup at the end that is called, it's the fourth cup. Thank you, Robbie.
It's debated because some of the Jews believe there is a fifth cup, that this is somehow, but okay. Please.
But it's Elijah's cup, and it's not drunk. It's an honorific until Elijah comes, and this was for him. So it's the last cup of wine at the end of the ceremony, and it's not consumed. At the Last Supper with Jesus, do you suppose there was a fourth cup? And it may in fact have been consumed because symbolically Elijah had come in the person of Jesus.
Yeah. What do you think? Yeah, so the fifth cup is Elijah's cup. At the Seder, you'll do four cups.
Mm-hmm.
There's debate whether or not this fifth cup is there, depending on the line of Judaism, depending on which Jew you're asking, because as they say, where they're two or three rabbis in a room, there's a fourth opinion.
Mm-hmm,
yeah. So everybody's got one, right?
Mm-hmm.
But a lot of scholars will believe that this fifth cup is this cup of suffering that Jesus says, if it be your will, Father, please let this cup pass from me. That this is a reference to, this cup of suffering.
Mm-hmm.
Jesus asked, there's James and John, the sons of Zebedee, the sons of thunder, who want to call down fire from heaven on the Samaritans, that old funny interaction, in sight line of, Mount Carmel, where Elijah calls down fire from heaven. They're thinking, hey, the fire was great for the prophets of Baal. Let's call down the fire on these Samaritans.
Hey, it worked once. Guys,
what's that?
It worked once. Let's give another whirl here.
That seemed fun back then. It'll be good now. So these guys are just like loose cannons. They're literally sons of thunder. They're mama's boys. Their mama says, grant that one of my sons sit on your right and left. And Jesus says, can you drink this cup that I am going to drink? He knows that he's going to drink this cup of suffering. It's also, a covenant, where we drink on it. We drink together. So a lot of folks believe that this fifth cup is in the Garden of Gethsemane, because this is where he's going next. And by the way, the Hallel Psalms are quoted by Jesus in the parable of the wicked tenants. He quotes Psalm 118, which is a Hallel Psalm. When they leave the Passover, it says that they sung a hymn together. And I'll put that in quotes. They sung a hymn together. What hymns do you sing at a Passover meal? You sing the Hallel Psalms. Well, Psalm 118 ends with this: bind the paschal sacrifice up to the horns of the altar. This is the last thing said or sung before Jesus goes to pray in the Garden of Gethsemane. So he knows that he is the Passover lamb that will be slain for the sins of the world, that his next step is a brutal beating, a mock trial, a crown of thorns. He is crowned with the curse. In the Garden of Eden, when Adam and Eve sinned against God, he said, the ground will be cursed, it will produce thorns and thistles, and Jesus is literally crowned with the curse.
It's amazing. And we've just scratched the surface of everything that happened that week. And Robbie, next week, let's look more at the trial, the crucifixion.
And the resurrection.
And the resurrection. Let's not forget that one. Yeah. We'll look forward to that. Robbie Pruitt, Pastor Robbie Pruitt, a member of the board again of Creation at Preserving Bible Times. PreservingBibleTimes.org is the website. They are loaded with biblical context there, both in written form, PDFs you can download, you know, files you can download and read, Doug Greenwald's writings and others. Also videos, and they're very busy converting all the old written materials to streaming. So it's an easy place to find context quickly, and there's a lot of free stuff there, too. Some of it you can purchase, but there's a lot of good information. I suggest you visit them. You can link to them from our site at BrokenRoadRadio.com if you're listening there today. But it's PreservingBibleTimes.org.
And go ahead and follow us on social media while you're at it. We'll post a few resources today on Monday, Thursday over at our Facebook page.
Good idea. Robbie, thank you. We'll talk to you next Thursday. That's the presumption here. We make allowances for schedules, though. Okay.
I'll be on vacay. We'll see how the internet connection is.
Yeah. Bye-bye.
I don't really.